The following podcast has been made possible by the generous members of our Patreons. So if you like our podcast, you want to join in and contribute and find mountains of other content while you're there, join in at patreon.com/IanBaldsworth and patreon.com/burialsandbeyond. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to Loopholes, episode 22, your weekly esoterotic discussion podcast. I am Ian Boldsworth, hi.
And I am Kate Cheryl, hello.
Oh, a bit more formal from Kate there. So, this week we are, as was agreed last week, demanded really, I suppose, by Dr. Kate, you said we have to do a Celebrity Sounds Corner as the main body.
Yes.
The main text.
Yeah, it's sort of Celebrity Seance. I think, as with all of these things, I wanted a celebrity seance, and then I just kept digging, and now I've just found this. It's a wider discussion point.
Have you done it again, what you did last week? Have you done the thing that you did last week where you were so busy stomping your feet to do Celebrity Seance Corner, it didn't even cross your mind that it wasn't a Celebrity Seance Corner?
Oh, no, this is. This is. I have anchored this. There are dead celebrities in Hunt. Well. There are claims of dead celebrity contact in here.
Okay, all right. Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, well, let's do the comments first from last week. I was very forceful also last week in instructing listeners to absolutely not tell us their dreams. They absolutely were forbidden from telling their dreams. So let's see if they've listened. Okay, so from my Patreon, I have Paul Kenny. As this is now a listener's dream podcast, have a listen to this. And then Paul said, not really, another great episode. So that's fine.
Paul, you trickster.
Joe McLaughlin said, I never remember to comment on these podcasts. Oh, cheers, Joe. Joe doesn't remember to comment on these podcasts, but on one of my other podcasts on Patreon, he has thus far recorded audio tracks of You're the One That I Want and If I Had $1 million by the Bare Naked Lady. So he's time for that.
Oh, yeah.
But he's not got time to sit down for a minute tops and write a comment. But Joe says, the glee with which you receive everyone else's, I felt I simply must. Love the show. I once dreamt it was 10 past 11. Thank you, Joe, for that. Annette Truby, Tonknado, Cult Comms, really enjoyed today's discussion. I'm not entirely sure I agree with you, though, in terms of the safety of these methods. Sensory deprivation can be used as a treatment, stroke therapy, so it's not inherently negative. Ultimately, it boils down to how it's applied. Should a person be locked in a blacked-out room with no means of escape and just white noise for company, that's torture. But choosing to don headphones and a mask with the ability to stop at any time is not harmful, in my opinion. I don't necessarily believe it allows ghosts to talk to you, but much like a spirit board, maybe it allows you to tap into your own psyche.
I'm kind of with her on the sensory deprivation, but I don't think that's as black and white, really. I think, of course, if you go and you spend, you know, however much money you want to be in one of those sensory deprivation pods and float in a lot of salt water for half an hour, then more power to you, because that's, you know, recommended in mental health type things, mindfulness and things like that. I think when you're going into a situation like that is based around sensory deprivation, by definition, you are safe because you're in a controlled environment and your goal is to relax rather than your goal is to talk to the dead. Whereas I think any instance where you're playing with faith and ghosts and the afterlife and things like that, I think just in general there needs to be an element of safeguarding there because of kind of the lingering nature of these belief systems and these kind of perceived phenomena.
How would one safeguard over that, though? How would you actually apply safeguarding? Because to address Annette's point, I'd still counter that. I would still say anything that alters your regular way of being, so anything that upsets your status quo in any way. So even a sensory deprivation tank that's meant for relaxation, even that, it alters your perception of what's happening. So we have eyes and ears, we have an awareness of what we have, and we adapt to our surroundings, okay? That's what happens within general life. Now, if you take away the eyes and the ears, you are very much on a different plane then, not literally, but you are very much on a different plane, and your status quo is upset. So spinning around and round to make yourself dizzy, like kids doing that, is really dangerous.
Yeah, I know. I once cut my chin open doing that.
Yeah, it's not just that. See? Even if you don't fall over, though. What that does to the brain, the reason you become dizzy is because you are in bother.
Yes,
your biology
yes.
is in bother. Anything that alters your perception and alters your biology, as I say, is a dangerous thing to mess about with.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And throwing in, as you say, the whole thing of belief systems and all of that, on top of that, which is psychologically harmful because that's how radicalization works. That's what radicalization is. Is it attacks that part of the brain and nurtures that part of the brain to not think clearly.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you couple those things together, I would consider that to be a pretty lethal combination.
I think, as well, if you're looking at ways to introduce safeguarding into the paranormal world, it's tricky in itself because the whole industry, and it is an industry, it's a massive money spinner for lots of people, and certainly lots of events companies, but it is, because it's a matter of faith, and it's kind of small, most ghost hunting events can't really go above, say, 30 people maximum. It is generally wildly unregulated. So there might be a need for more people to step in and consider the mental state or the well-being of would-be ghost hunters and visitors. There just isn't the infrastructure there to offer it.
But you can't do that and keep passing the plate around. In a church, you can't speak clearly to people and tell them to consider all possibilities. In order to keep your flock keeping their hand in their pocket and putting what's in there into your pocket, you need to keep them radicalised.
I think radicalised is too strong a word to use in terms of most contemporary faith groups. Oh, right, okay. Well, I think using the word radicalised, that's very, a very, very charged statement. You know, not every little old granny is running around the street with, a placard.
And intentionally charged. I'm intentionally charging that statement. Yeah. But at the core of that, I do believe in it. So with my simple thinking that I like to do, it is the same thing.
Whereas I think because a lot of church structures, a lot of faith-based structures nowadays, especially just speaking from the UK and from my limited interaction with different denominations, there are safeguarding plans and there are groups within the church structure that deal exclusively with, mental health, with safeguarding, and with kind of, the more ethical side of things.
I'm not doubting any of that.
Some of which does include, esoteric beliefs and things. But when it comes to paranormal things, I think my concern at the minute has come from a lot of social media posts that I've been seeing recently, where I've just been more concerned about the capabilities, not in a professional sense, as I'm sure these people are very good tour guides and hosts, but the wider capabilities of individuals who are overseeing large groups of people dealing with incredibly emotionally charged environments. Yeah, how those are being promoted on social media, some of which then will very publicly insult other religions and use their imagery within their own investigations, if that makes sense. I think
if this was a fun fair, if this was a touring fun fair, the equivalent of it would be them not safety testing the rides.
Yes.
Whacking up a big wheel and going, on you go. And no one's even checked all the bolts are on properly. It's not even been checked. And they're not even bothered as long as you pay your fiver to get on it in the first place.
And the person operating it is a drunk toddler.
So that's what I'm getting at. So in simple thinking, if we take away faith and all those lofty ideals, which are hugely important within them, that's what's happening in these environments. Not definitively in all of them, but that is the game that's being played. And why I use the word radicalising is because, like we would talk about radicalising into terrorist groups or whatever, what you are doing is you are persuading someone that your non-tangible, non-provable belief is absolutely correct and reality, and they must act according to it. That is exactly what's happening in the paranormal world.
Yeah, I'd personally simplify it by saying I'd like to see more guidelines that are placed, the same guidelines that are placed onto recognised faith groups and recognised places of worship and gatherings just in general, applied to the paranormal. Because I think although it's kind of a hobbyist group, because it's quite left field. Few people are keen to get their hands dirty and look into what would actually keep people safe and what would benefit these groups.
Can I just go like bowling or something or go to the pitches? I mean, it's actually cheaper.
Yeah, and I think really I'm just a party pooper. I just want rules. I just want to ruin everyone's fun. And I want to stop haunted houses using Palm Sunday crosses as a means to incite demonic activity.
That's what I heard about you as well. Jeremy Light says, the God helmet discussion of weak magnets inside a helmet I found hilarious, as I essentially have one. As I, like most of the motorcyclists, have a Bluetooth communication system installed in my helmet, and what are speakers but small magnetic devices right next to the side of my head? Never hallucinated that a third man was riding on the pillion seat. Speaking of oversimplified arguments. Guy Wilson said, to answer the most important question in this episode, I pronounce werewolf the same as Dr. Kate, i.e. like the river Weir.
Yes.
The werewolf.
Thank you.
However, this may relate back to a school trauma when I was marked down on some sort of creative writing task by a teacher who insisted it must be spelt W-H-E-R-E. And since it was the days before the internet, I had no way to prove otherwise. Another great episode, count me in for the 4-hour Enfield special. Screen grab that. So yourself and Guy are both wrong, but Guy at least has mitigating circumstances that he was abused at school. Steve Jones, Ian's private researcher. That's not to do with loopholes. What are these marshmallows of which you speak? I have heard of marshmallows, but not marshmallows.
I'm being bullied by speech goblins. So,
I never pulled you up on marshmallows. I think I say marshmallows as well, I think.
Marshmallow.
I think marshmallow's all right. I'm not pulling you up on that.
Yeah.
Steve, who's having a go at you, mate. Christopher Adragna. So I may have missed it, or it may be a US-UK thing, but what is a dinner lady, Kate? Actually, I don't need you to do it, because Guy Wilson has jumped in and said, the non-loopholes definition is a person who serves lunch to young school children. I guess in the US they would be an elementary school cafeteria worker. So, no need for us to reply. It has now become a discussion board. Do you want to define dinner ladies? Do you want to define dinner ladies in terms of, that's correct,
yes,
what Guy has said to
you. Yeah, it is.
In terms of what the actual job is. But the relatability would be fussy, mothery folk.
But with a nasty streak.
Yeah, which dinner ladies don't have.
Women that
don't
worked...
have to be women.
Oh, no, they don't, do they?
No, even when they said motherly then, it's like, it doesn't matter. Yeah. You know, it's just an authority figure in a familial way who has their arms around people.
Yeah.
However, in the loopholes definition of dinner ladies, as you were just saying, with quite a nasty, vicious streak.
Yes, yeah, they present as fluffy, generally wearing a fleece, but underneath it all is a viper.
Yes, exactly that. Yeah, yeah. And don't think twice about what they're defending. It's a mother hen sort of figure, I guess.
Yeah, a twisted mother hen.
Now I'll have to explain to Christopher what a mother hen is as well.
Right,
This is going to go on and on.
Right, it's like a really small buffalo with wings. They have them in America, don't they?
Patrick Coughlin has said, for your screen-grabbing pleasure, I would enjoy an Enfield special. It's grabbed. Shane Darrell said, yes, I did used to work at the radio station. Okay, because I said last week that Shane used to work on a radio show that I used to do.
Yes.
I've always been into esoterica, and the recent sleep paralysis chat is very close to my semi-conscious heart. Hang on, this is getting dangerous already. The 2015 film The Nightmare is very interesting in describing the hag and hat man, etc., with different personal accounts, which helps me realise it wasn't paranormal and just a thing that happens to a lot of people sometimes. I can feel this at the moment. I can feel a dream coming.
Yeah. It's skirting there, isn't it?
I used to be able to make it happen by sleeping on my side with my arm in a certain position. Here we are. I once had a hallucination that Snoop Dogg was looking at me through my bedroom window through a small hole. Lots of spiders were crawling out of the hole, and Snoop said, you ain't going to be able to do nothing about these spiders, and he disappeared. So.
Right, that gets a free pass.
That one can stay. Completely. And finally on my one, Siobhan Jenner said, the pronunciation of werewolf has just come up at home whilst watching a Lego show about building spooky locations. The pronunciation should be werewolf. And I have just found out that my husband pronounces it werewolf. We've been married 21 years. Is that grounds for divorce? I'd say yes. I think you need to find a like-minded person, Siobhan, so I think you and I should run away together. pronounced werewolf however we want to.
Meanwhile, me and your soon-to-be ex-husband will have a lovely time in our new Lego love pad. Thank you.
Yeah, you can do that, absolutely. But please be aware that while you're both there, you're pronouncing words wrong. Siobhan continues, also they refer to the Frankenstein figure as reanimated monster. Does Kate have any idea why? Could it be a copyright thing or just Australian thing?
No, I think Frankenstein.
Sorry, before you... No, whoa. Oh. Hang on a minute.
Oh,
hang on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Why is it... Does Kate have any idea why? We've only just run off together. We're having our first row straight away. Why have you deferred to Kate?
It's because she secretly wants me to. And me, her ex-husband and her are going to live together in a little Lego trio love nest.
There you go. That's your career finished. I think, I don't know this for certain, by the way, but I think it will be to do with Universal Monsters. It'll be to do with Universal owning the rights of Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
I've had a private issue with that of late because I have an animated show where there is a Frankenstein in it that is called Frank, and that may prove to be an issue. So I would imagine they just don't have the rights to call it Frankenstein in terms of the design of it and all that sort of business.
I think visually, the visuals of the Universal Monsters, Frankenstein's monster, that would most likely be the issue, wouldn't it? Whereas the name itself fell out of copyright many, many years ago. That's why you can get so many different editions of the novel.
But the melding of the name with the visual would be owned by Universal.
Yeah. Does that answer the question?
Well, the visual as well, though. I know too much about this, really. The visual as well is hugely debatable in terms of the bolts through the neck, for example,
is a
no-go. However, bolts through the head is absolutely fine. So you can mess about with a visual, but you have to alter a certain amount of things, and even then there is room for debate. Should we get away from this admin?
Yeah, okay.
It's almost certainly that, though, Siobhan.
So on my comments, Paul Kenny said, Ace episode, the more talk of Freddy in Star Wars, the better. With all the talk on the God helmet, it got me thinking of the chrono visor, which helped a guy pretend to take a photo of Jesus. Oh, and I've always pronounced it werewolf, like in Young Frankenstein.
2-1 at the moment.
Right, well. But the chronovisor's a good call.
Do you know about that?
I know a little bit about it. It's one of these sort of pseudo-sciency instruments that's reportedly in the depths of the Vatican. It was this Father Pellegrino Onetti.
Okay.
Who claimed to have made this device. I think he said it was in like the 50s, out of mysterious metals, lots of wishy-washy terms. And it's like a time-travelling video camera, or like a viewing sort of thing.
Is it non-confirmed as a thing?
It's, well, no one knows if it exists, it's just based on a lot of claims. Okay. And he's since died now, there were like deathbed confessions and things.
What was his deathbed confession?
I think it was to do with like other translations of work he'd done, so it threw a lot of his claims into dodgy territory.
But it wasn't to do with his Chronovision helmet?
I don't know, I haven't read them all, I'm afraid. So I can put that on my research list.
Okay.
But I do know he said that using this sort of weird viewer into the past, so you could see things any time in the past, you couldn't interact with them, so it wasn't like actual time travel, but he had seen speeches from like Mussolini and Napoleon and would like compliment them on their
and I shall follow it to the letter
on their style.
I saw it with my own eyes.
And then he said, obviously, you're in the Vatican, you're all of that business, you're Captain Catholic, so what do you want to do? You want to go and see the last days of Christ. You want to see Jesus being crucified. Because, of course, you don't want to see any of the nice things in his life. You want to see the final bloody hours.
Let's not debate the thing that he was lying about going seeing. And the validity of what he went to see. He didn't go and see anything.
But he claimed...
I've got one of them Chronovision visors. I've got one. It's under the stairs. Yeah. Do you want to see it? Whenever you're next to my house, do you want me to show it to you?
Yeah, I do.
I'm not going to, but I have got one. I have got it, and I have used it, and I've seen loads of things from the past, but I'm not showing it you.
But I do know that when him and his mates went to watch Jesus, they took a picture, a snapshot, to take home as a souvenir.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was published in a newspaper in early 70s. And then it turned out that it was like a reversed postcard.
Who thinks they'll get away with that? Who finds an image, like an artistic image that's been made of that, and then goes, oh, just flip it. If you just flip it, then you won't be able to tell.
So that's the extent of my knowledge on that. But it's a lovely if flawed idea.
I've never heard about it before. Other than the one I've got under the stairs, of course.
Of course, of course. Yeah, well, they didn't really take off, did they?
It's next to my PlayStation VR.
Annette Truby says, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on Estes, because I know you've done it and you got quite spooked when doing it for the Haunted Homecoming series. Did you feel at risk or vulnerable? In hindsight, does it make you question the safety of it? And then she says, and it's werewolf. Sorry, Kate.
Yes.
Well, you're all mental.
Can I say something about that?
Okay.
Because I know, as you know as well, that there was a great deal of care taken of you, and there was a great deal of care taken in safeguarding within that production.
Oh, yeah, fantastic. And
there is a moment within that series where you have a bit of a funny turn, and I've seen you do that in real life. So I know that that's quite a frightening thing to be near when it happens, you know, because you're not, with respect, you're not that good an actor that you could pull that off.
Thank you.
To make it look like... No, but I'm validating your experience within that show, basically. So I know that you weren't putting that on. I could see, because I'd seen it in real life, I could see, oh, that's what she does when she's in that sort of situation. So I was kind of concerned for you, even though I knew that what I was watching was in the past and I knew you were fine. But there was a slight concern for you there, because I did feel like you'd been tipped up a little bit, not intentionally or maliciously, but I felt like the games you were all playing, as I see them, had tipped you up mentally for a moment. But I do know absolutely that you were taken care of.
Yeah, I think I'm very fortunate that my only experience with paranormal programming has been a really, really positive one, and that nothing was forced during the filming of that. But certainly the Estes stuff, I didn't feel at risk as such, because I know I was surrounded by the crew who I trusted, but spiritually vulnerable. I think when you get in that headspace and you think there's actually something here, it's more of like a flashpoint fear rather than I feel wholly vulnerable that something terrible is going to happen to me. But I never felt unsafe.
Going forward, are you quite happy to just do that whenever now?
Yeah, I feel a lot happier doing Estes stuff than I do Ouija stuff even.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm absolutely fine with it.
Right.
And PJ was quite taken with the God Helmet idea that nuns would encounter something spiritual because that's their association with the sort of feelings that the helmet's stimulating. Whereas Dawkins may experience the same sensations, but describe them as fuzzy or tingly.
I thought there was no response from Dawkins. I thought that Dawkins drew a blank when...
Well, he just said he said he felt quite cosy and relaxed, didn't he? So I think it's a good point to make that we could, you know, multiple people could be experiencing the same sensation, but interpret it in different ways, depending on their life experience and their learned or religious beliefs.
Is there any sort of vibration that goes through that helmet, do you know? Could it relax you in that way?
I don't know. I mean, we could have a crack at making one.
Well, we need stuff that vibrates, and I'm not going in on Summers for it. You can go get it.
Well, I think my loyalty card's run out.
I'd mess about. I can't stop myself.
Well, PJ continues that the bigger mystery for me is how does material matter create non-material consciousness? This seems to be where a purely material inquiry of the brain breaks down. There's an American doctor who specialises in anaesthetics called Stuart Hameroff. Is that a real name?
Maybe that's a description of how he gets them to sleep.
He notes how anaesthetics are able to temporarily turn off consciousness, and he uses that as a starting point for investigation of consciousness.
Right.
And I'd put money on someone somewhere using sedatives to try and see ghosts.
Do you definitely not dream with anaesthetic?
I don't know.
I have a memory of having anaesthetic when I was very young at the dentist, and I definitely had dreams. But I think there might have been crossover dreams. So I remember that there was a picture on the wall in the dentist's which had a sailing ship on it. Mm-hmm. And I saw the sailing ship sail off.
Oh, so they're more like hallucinations or hallucinations?
Yes, potentially. So I was looking at that. But I don't know if I went to sleep, or was put to sleep rather, and then dreamt I was still looking at the thing on the wall, or whether that was happening live and I was trippy with it. You know, I'm not sure. But I've always assumed that was a dream within the anaesthesia. Can someone let us know if you're put under by anaesthetic, if you dream or if you cannot dream at all, if it's impossible?
And Rob Graves said, great episode, just listen while sick in bed with COVID. Oh, I'm sorry, Rob. Oh, and I've gone off in now. I wholeheartedly agreed with your opinions, Ian. Says, between EMPs, infrasound, sleep paralysis, carbon monoxide poisoning and general suggestibility, Most supernatural events can be rationalised, all still fascinating though. See? It's all good. Even if you can explain it, still worth chatting about.
I'm here, aren't I? I've never argued that. I've never said it's not interesting at any point in all my debates. I'm here. I'm talking about it.
I know. It's
just
okay.
Nonsense. It's just nonsense.
With the Estes method, I feel there's an air of stage magic when it's used on ghost hunting shows, in that we as viewers have no proof that the person is even using the spirit box. They could just be listening to the other people's questions through the mic feed and making up responses. Not that I'm accusing you of that, Kate.
What I can say on that is in real life, and I'm sure you will all know enough about me by now, that I would not uphold the pretense of someone maintaining this was real.
Yeah.
In real life, I have put that to Kate.
Yes.
And I have even argued it with Kate as well. And thus far, she is holding true.
Yeah.
That exactly what was on the screen is exactly real.
100%.
I might be projecting because I've made visual extravaganzas that had trickery involved.
What? No.
Oh, that makes me look different, doesn't it? It makes me look very different, doesn't it?
Oh, you trickster.
Maybe I'm not the villain you think I am.
Dun, dun, dun. Rob goes on to say that there's a show called Hellion. I think he might mean Hellier. That as a skeptic, I had a massive laugh watching and thought about this. The whole method seems to be to literally create the illusion of a double blind experiment. But if a spirit was communicating through the radio, what does the human middleman add apart from the opportunity to lie and some showmanship?
And I'm sorry, Rob, that you got pulled up and kind of talked down to there about, I think he means Hellier.
He might have just done it wrong
because he's delirious. Can we not pick on poorly people, please?
You'd love Hellier. There's goblins in it.
and I'm known for liking goblins. Oh, I'm a proper little bugger for a goblin film.
You are, aren't you?
Point me to a goblin and I'm there. I have never expressed that sentiment. Welcome to Loopholes.
So, for this week's discussion, I thought we would have a extended celebrity seance corner.
You say thought, you demanded it.
With additional discussion points.
Right, okay.
When I look for celebrity seances, I mainly just try and think of celebs, brackets, dead ones.
Yeah.
And then go around my usual seancey sources and see if anyone has had a bash at chatting to them.
If all your career ambitions and things don't ever come to fruition, you know, if you don't carry on working in telly, or you don't carry on being a writer, or you never hit the goals that you wish to hit yourself, can I put forward a good potential income stream for you would be to branch out in much the same way that Paul Newman did with his salad dressings and stuff into your own brand of cooking sauces called Seancey Sauces.
Oh, I'd be on board with that. Yeah.
Dr. Kate Cheryl's Seancey Sauces.
Or Saucy Seances. That might be an even bigger seller.
Whichever you wish to do. If it comes to that.
I'm getting old
now. You've got
now.
To do seances in a cold church in just your pants. By all means, you do that.
But in the meantime, seances with celebrities. I found like a big celeb, couldn't find that many seances with them. And then I found this little clip of a much larger show.
Okay.
And then it led into a bit of a rabbit hole. Sort of like a mini obsession with this little known medium. It was once successful, but has now sort of faded into obscurity a bit. So what I'd like to discuss this week started from, this is the seance itself, was Fox TV's Power of the Paranormal.
Wow, so you're going after a big gun here.
Yeah, it was live on stage. It was in May 2000. It was a two-hour special with a medium called Bill Burns.
Okay.
The whole recording doesn't seem to be available anywhere nowadays, so I haven't been able to watch the whole thing. But I've pieced together lots of clips from YouTube and from Wayback Machine and archive stuff.
Have you looked into why it might not be available?
It's like so many of these programmes that happened on like the millennium in the late 90s, pre-YouTube.
Okay. Yeah.
When nowadays everything on the internet is forever, whereas a lot of these earlier shows are just, no one taped them and no one bothered uploading them.
So we could piece together perhaps that it wasn't particularly a popular show.
I don't think it was groundbreaking, no.
Mind you, that said, the Michael Jackson seance took a long time to get to YouTube in its full form.
And it did, yeah.
I couldn't be more of a fan of that programme.
It is a classic. I mean, that's what we're all aiming for, ultimately, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, this one I found very interesting, because I went after this seance because I wanted to find a Marilyn Monroe seance.
Okay.
Thought, Hollywood icon, this is a channeling medium, by a man.
And questions and mystery surrounding her death.
Exactly. And yeah. In the room, they had her first husband, Jim Doherty, who at the time was in his 80s.
Right.
So they had someone very close to her in the room, as they often do with these sort of live seances. Like with the Michael Jackson one, they had David Guest. But also, this is a 2-hour seance. It's not like the Twitter seance where they tried to contact 5 people over an hour.
Mm.
They tried to contact 2 people during this Powers of the Paranormal seance.
Right.
One was Marilyn Monroe. So yeah. Who would you put with Marilyn Monroe?
JFK.
Andy Kaufman.
Why? Why?
That's our
the
first
last
discussion point.
You want on a seance is Andy Kaufman, who was famous for messing about with people, and it was his entire raison d'etre was to turn everything upside down and for nobody to know what was real, what wasn't real. Andy Kaufman coming through on a seance is not going to give you straight answers about anything. In fact, he'll probably pretend to be someone else. When they went through to Andy Kaufman, was it Tony Clifton that turned up? Seance, well, mails, trance.
Well, you know what? In the afterlife, he was remarkably more sedate.
Kaufman was he? Yeah.
Yeah, he was. But like Monroe's first husband, at this seance, they also had Bob Zemuda and Lynn Margulies, who was Kaufman's sort of writing partner / Tony Clifton wrangler.
Yes.
And his girlfriend.
So Bob Zemuda and Lynn Margulies were both there at this.
They were in the room.
I mean, I can't speak about Lynn Margulies, but I know that Zemuda would go to the opening of an envelope.
Yeah, well, he must have been hammering on this door because he was there for the whole 2 hours.
Right.
So
can I just skip ahead for a second? What year was this, did you say?
2000.
And in the story that you're about to tell us, does I would assume from what you said about him being sedate that Andy does turn up in the seance?
Oh, he does.
So confirmed, a confirmed death there we have. We have a confirmed
yes.
death.
Yes.
Okay, well, Bob Zemuda published a book, I believe in 2016, 17, maybe something like that, called Andy Kaufman, The Truth, where Bob Zemuda maintained in very forceful terms, really.
Mm.
I mean, he dressed it up as being, oh, could be, couldn't be. But Zemuda maintained that he believed wholeheartedly that Andy Kaufman was still alive in that book. Now, yeah. What's what here?
Well, I think this is why I find it such an interesting seance. Like, Marilyn Monroe, she is very much dead. We know she is dead.
All right, don't rub it in.
Sorry. Still an icon. But then why would you then
try and channel...
Hey, Marilyn,
you know you're dead? You are very much dead.
Why'd you try and channel someone who, like, part of his legacy is he even dead?
Yeah.
It seemed like a really... Not just an odd choice in putting him and Monroe together, but... Mm. Getting into that sort of weird, tricksy world that he lived in.
Well, we don't
in.
Know for certain, that even though that was his stock in trade when he was alive, we don't know for certain with Andy Kaufman that he would necessarily have wanted that to go past his death. You know, that he would have necessarily
yeah.
wanted there to be a debate
yes.
about whether he was alive or dead. So Zemuda and Lynn Margulies, I guess, really would know that better than other people. And mm-hmm. as I've already stated, Zemuda has been contradictory within that.
Yes.
You know, the fact that he's took part in a seance speaking to Andy Kaufman, but also maintains that Andy Kaufman's still alive. However, as I say, stock in trade. What is real was their absolute reason for being.
Yes.
So, you know, it can be contradictory because that further messes with people's perception of what's going on.
Yeah. Firstly, we'll get into Bill Burns a bit deeper afterwards, because I think he's a very interesting character that we need to discuss.
Can we just say that he's a villain from the off? Can we not just do that?
No, because I got really entrenched in this Bill Burns story. Once you've gone so deep into like old social media and old lectures and things, we'll go through it. It was a roller coaster. But in life, Bill Burns was a no-nonsense business and life coach.
Right.
Who offered personal and business empowerment. And he was also kind of a psychic counsellor to the stars, a motivational speaker, a medium, and a channeler.
What's a psychic counsellor to the stars? What's that? To people who are still living, or does he do it to the spirits of stars that have died?
Well, I think the payment options might be a bit tricky if you start ministering to the dead.
Well, how many estates has he gone to and said, look, you owe me money?
I tried to find his rates. Back in 2002, he was charging $275 for a one-hour session.
Right. Was this with or without happy ending?
Shut up! He was because a trance and a psychic
I can't say
medium.
That's a ridiculous amount of money until I know that.
But professionals... Professionals would come to him for advice.
I'm going to keep that mistake in the edit, if you don't mind, because that sounded like you were about to say hand job.
No. I was trying to say very, very innocently that there was an instance where one of his clients was a literary agent.
Okay.
I think this is very poor business practice, would bring him a list of potential clients seeking representation. And he would use his psychic powers to screen them without knowing what they'd written or their abilities and then transfer the best ones to her.
But, I mean, that's no more arbitrary than what they do anyway.
Well, yes, but, you know, that are the sort of services that he offered.
Right, OK.
On the surface.
Yeah. Okay. Then we've both made a mistake here in sort of passively slagging him off. We both should have made friends with him.
Yes, definitely.
We're never getting our book deals now, mate.
Oh, no. If any mediums with contacts to agents would like to get in touch.
Yeah.
So he's a very interesting, strange bloke. And so there's a lot of footage online of him channeling the dead. So he's one of these mediums who doesn't just hear things and then or sense them and tells people what he's feeling. The dead actually speak through him. So after he's done his literal 20 seconds of jiggling about, then whatever comes out of his mouth is believed to be the words of the deceased. It's got a very high hit rate if these videos are anything to go by. So,
does he do the voices?
No, he does slightly different intonation and different wording, but it's still his voice. So there's no dodgy accents here, sadly.
Okay.
Which I was really hoping for with the Monroe stuff. So, Andy Kaufman. It was a very strange, unsurprisingly, way that Andy came through. He didn't come back with any revelations and didn't really come back with an awful lot of sense, which might actually be quite on brand. But a lot of it seemed to be relating to his post-death legacy and things like the film Man on the Moon.
Right, okay.
When Andy came through, very handy, straight on time, very polite boy, he said, oh, they want to know what I think of what's been done. I never knew what I was going to do anyway. So who could capture that? They can capture what I did and explain what I did. They missed out a few things, which was probably a good thing. I know they expect me to do something about love. But what I have, what I feel now, is loss and gratitude for those who were there on nights I couldn't make it alone.
Right. There's an interesting crossover here that's just occurred to me.
Mm.
There's a documentary called Jim and Andy, which is about Jim Carrey's approach to playing Andy Kaufman and with a lot of documentary footage that was shot at the time. Now, cut a long story short, Jim Carrey was method and was Andy Kaufman for the entire filming when he wasn't being Tony Clifton.
It was method beyond method, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, well, and he was Tony Clifton as well, which is a character that Andy Kaufman also did, but maintained it wasn't him, who was very abrasive, brash, misogynistic, like all the wrong things Tony Clifton was. So Jim Carrey would also inhabit that character on days when he was playing Tony Clifton in the movie Man on the Moon. And Jim Carrey maintains within that documentary, it's a fascinating documentary, it's really good as well, it's dead funny. He maintains within that documentary that Andy Kaufman, when Jim Carrey got the job, or maybe just before he got the job, Andy Kaufman spoke to him on a beach and said, I am going to be playing myself in this film.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim Carrey was maintaining really that he was channeling Andy Kaufman. So there's precedent for this. There's precedent for Kaufman coming from beyond the grave. However, I would put up a note of caution with the film Jim and Andy in that the truth may be in plain sight with that film.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be happening right in front of you. Okay. In that Jim Carrey channels, quote unquote, Andy Kaufman for that film. He is mischievous. He is naughty. He is doing things that are probably illegal, really. I'm sure people had grounds to sue as a result of it.
Oh, God, definitely.
However, it seemed that everyone was on the same page. It seemed that everyone understood what was going on. Even the director, when offered an out, Milos Forman, when offered an out for Jim Carrey to just be himself,
mm-hmm.
said, no, I don't want that. I want you to carry on doing what you're doing, even though it is slowly killing me.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. However, we are talking about, Zemuda was on set and Lynn was on set as well. We are talking about a group of people here who are well adept in messing with your mind. They are well adept yes. with not portraying the truth or portraying a version of the truth or making you believe something is real when it isn't real. They're all well adept to that. And they've got this new kid in the fold as well in Jim Carrey who's playing their departed friend. So the truth may be in plain sight with the Jim and Andy movie. The Jim and Andy movie may well be a work of fiction. It yeah. might be. The whole story about it, that the footage was locked away in Jim Carrey's office for 20 years, that it was never going to be released, they built up the legend of that. It was known that that footage existed, and they built up the legend of that. However, the loophole in all that, for me, is this might be nonsense. This might be a big performance piece maintaining that Jim Carrey acted like that on a movie, because I personally can't see how a movie got made if he was acting like that the whole time. I'm not sure how that's even possible to make that movie. So for all we know, the footage in the film Jim and Andy is literally the only footage that was ever taken. And they were like, okay, we've got all that now. Let's release that in 20 years. Now let's crack on with making this film. Yeah. You know, Zemuda, you go out and say there's this footage and you don't think it's ever going to be released.
Yeah.
You know, put it in your books and think, you know, let's build the legend of this and then one day we'll release it. And it's still brilliant, but it might be right in front of you what's gone on there.
Yeah, I think the whole nature of Kaufman. You know, a few weeks ago when we looked at the life and times of Leslie Flint or Billy Chutney.
Billy Chutney, yes.
Billy Chutney. We looked at Billy Chutney, who channeled great many people from the past and like a dead Victorian Cockney child. He channeled Oscar Wilde, who was one of them. And at the time we said, you're aiming pretty high if you're wanting to channel one of the world's greatest wits.
Yeah.
And you haven't really got something fantastic prepared because people are going to see through that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I think from the other side of the coin, that's kind of where Kaufman sits. Like, if you're going to channel someone who was, or maybe is, depending on what you believe, notoriously wild and unstable and changing.
You see, I would say the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
I think Andy Kaufman is the easiest person because the real Andy Kaufman is unknown.
Yeah, I suppose.
Nobody knows who Andy Kaufman is at all. So, as long as you've got the validation of Lynn there and Zemuda mm-hmm. there, people that knew him behind the mask, as long as they're not saying, this doesn't sound like Andy at all.
Yes.
If they'll confirm this really does sound like him, nobody in the public knows what he's like at all. Because even when he was on interviews and things, he was pretending.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. But where I find it interesting is there's a live feed and a TV camera pointed at them. And I think that's where it gets into tricky territory. Because, no one knew the real Andy Kaufman apart from these people. But even if the spirit of Andy Kaufman was coming through and he clocked that there was a TV camera, that this was being made for entertainment purposes, could he resist? You know, how could he come through as his authentic self when that authentic self was literally never shown to the public?
Yeah.
You know, it's just loopholes within loopholes within loopholes. And we've also got baffling.
The infamous medium get-out clause of saying, well, that's what they're saying to me. Don't blame me. That's what I'm getting.
Yeah. Well,
even if they say, this doesn't sound like Andy at all. Well, don't blame me. I'm just telling you what I'm getting.
Yes, yeah.
Nothing to do with me.
Well, when Andy was coming through Bill Burns, he did thank... Ooh, sorry, that's very poor wording, isn't it? We didn't really thank Bob or Lynn by name, but he thanked the people around him who helped him get through the insanity of my own mind, I quote, who would stroke and encourage and bleed inside and sometimes give him the kick to wake him up, perhaps.
Right.
Very few of his sentences made an awful lot of sense.
Yeah, but we don't know what he's been reading in heaven, do we?
Exactly. Yeah, no, you're right. But he did say that he had something that he needed to say to them before he went, because he didn't really stay that long. I imagine there was a lot of advert breaks in this original two-hour broadcast.
Right.
But he said, "It may be incredible to be genius, an odd word that. It's better to be able to apply it, to make it practical. We'll work on that." To which Bob said, "He's the real McCoy."
And then wrote a book about how he thinks he's still alive.
He's still alive, yeah.
Did this spirit of Andy Kaufman mention his quote-unquote illegitimate daughter?
Not in the clips that I've seen.
No, okay.
But one of the interesting things I found
reading... I hate
that reading,
word. I hate saying illegitimate.
It's unpleasant.
But I'm just that's just the only way I can explain that this was a daughter that he had. She was given up to foster care, as far as I recall, his daughter. Mm-hmm. And never met him. She never actually met Andy Kaufman. But she found out she was his daughter. And interestingly, if you are to believe Jim and Andy, met Jim Carrey in character as Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
And spent an hour or so with him.
Powerful and... I don't know. I don't know how to think about that.
Well, I presume that everyone was consenting. You know, I presume Carrey was happy to do it and she was happy to meet him. You know, she wasn't under the impression that it was Andy Kaufman. So she, you know, she... just kind of role play. There's footage in that Jim and Andy movie as well, where his family are there. And
It's almost like a living seance. When you see biopics where the family of the deceased are still involved and you know they're interacting with this actor portraying their family member, it's sort of like a living seance in a sense, especially like with Jim Carrey when he went so method. I think there's a weird crossover there.
But, there is... I know I just said that it's consensual, but there is, again, this... There are safeguarding considerations to take into account there, you know, of is that morally correct to do that? Mm-hmm. I've personally got no issue with it, but there is a question there of, is it wrong to do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, another way of looking at it, I guess, would be what Jim Carrey was doing in that situation, where he was portraying Andy Kaufman to members of his own family who were role-playing with him as if he was actually their son or their brother or sister, is kind of the same... as a medium saying they are speaking your husband's voice or your departed wife's voice or whatever. It's kind of the same thing. I guess, and that Jim Carrey was armed with the research to do that.
Yeah.
With a degree of integrity and with authenticity, I suppose.
There's so many loopholes and twists with... the idea of Kaufman coming back. But when I looked into how Bill Burns sort of explained the methods of his channeling, like you said, he just spoke as they did.
Thank you very much.
He put sort of a loophole of his own into his own mediumship, which I found very interesting. So when Kaufman came through, wasn't making a lot of sense. When Monroe came through, she was a bit garbled. And in other instances where, like, he's channeled murder victims and things like that, which again is big hefty discussion point.
Well, I'm happy to say he's a piece of shit then. Now,
well, it's very murky, but with the Kaufman thing, he said that in these instances where he can't pick up on specifics, you know, if there are things missing from what this person should know in life, he explains it as that when a spirit leaves Earth, so when they're not haunting or possessing an individual...
It's going to make me angry, isn't it? You memory... know that what you're about to tell me is going to make me angry.
No,
go on, say it.
Memory is the first thing to leave the spirit when you die. So it's more like an echo of the soul and of the personality.
Based on what,
than like a coherent comprehension of what happened
to
their life.
Show you're working out, Bill. Based on what? Show me you're working out. Present your evidence how you've come to that conclusion, how you've decided that that's a fact. The memory is the first thing to go. Based on what? Based on that you haven't got time to Google Andy Kaufman's entire life before you do the seance. That's what it's based on.
Well, he said this in relation to... This was more in relation to Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, all right. Well, whoever it is then. Based on what? Answer me, Bill. Based on what? Have they told you that? Oh, I can't really remember anything me now.
But I found with Monroe, this was even more sort of, even more pertinent, really.
Memory is the first thing to go. Oh my goodness.
But I found this even more pertinent when he was channeling Monroe. And Monroe's seance was heart-wrenching and kind of unpleasant. It was more of an unpleasant listen than Kaufman's. Kaufman's was just bizarre in that it was even happening. But with Monroe's, first of all, she spoke like Yoda. She was saying things like, scared, broken, frightened I was. Which, is, as we all know, is exactly how Monroe spoke.
But we also all know, and this is an important point, we also all know what her story was. We all know of the life that she led. And the tremendous highs and the tremendous lows that were involved in that. Even laymen know enough about Marilyn Monroe that it was heart-wrenching and it was heartbreaking. So to exploit that in death...
And it seems as though, in at least in Burns's interpretation, she carried this depression and this low sensation with her into the afterlife.
Why? Why would she do that? Exactly. Surely she can't even remember what happened.
Well, she
said... Hang on a minute, Bill.
she said to her her first husband.
Yeah.
So again, this old man who sat there, who was kind of visibly, emotionally, a little bit rattled.
Okay, so horrific.
There were times that I told you I was sorry.
Yeah.
That I wasn't equal to the challenge of your love. I wish the clock would go back. And then she said that I'm not here, as in the afterlife, because it's deliberate. So again, that's kind of suggesting the nature of her death.
So that's her first husband she's speaking to now?
Yes. I'm here because I got bigger than I could hold. I didn't quit. Right. I was crushed. And then Burns decided to say, it's very funny being in a man's body.
This is foul. This is absolutely foul. And also, I'm sure that the listener is already ahead of me at the moment, this was her first husband.
Yes.
So way back this was. Way back in her life. Way back.
Yeah.
Yet the memory is the first thing to go. I would have taken that as more authentic if he'd gone, this is me now. This is me, Marilyn, talking. Do you want to speak to this gentleman? I have no idea who that is. Is that your first husband? What my first? Was I married? I can't remember any of that.
Well, I think if you think that's unpleasant...
I think it's all unpleasant. Crook. He's a crook.
When I was searching for instances of Bill Burns on film, like I watched a lot of lectures, a lot of them are just like motivational speeches. So I can see why he would make a living as that, but as he got older, he moved more into like metaphysics and seance and things like that as his like bread and butter.
I'm not validating this man in any way, shape or form. Hitler was a good painter from all accounts. We're not doing that.
But there's a three-part video series that I found that I won't link to because I don't... It makes me feel very uncomfortable.
Okay.
But I thought initially that he'd been asked by this gentleman's family to channel him. And now I think maybe he wasn't asked by the family and this is just someone unrelated who wanted to hold a seance for a victim in a very famous murder case.
What are you doing to me today? Why have you brought all that? Why are you trying to get me wound up?
I think this is really important to just mention because this is so rife today on YouTube.
Okay.
So I will mention the individual because it's a very, very famous case. Like, this was a chap called Travis Alexander who was very brutally murdered by an ex-girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular case, it was a huge court case at the time. It's been on countless podcasts, countless TV shows, countless exploitative TV shows, one of which was called Murder House Flip, which admittedly was an online streaming platform. But this man and his legacy have been exploited by so many different media outlets. And I always think that true crime in itself is interesting as it is, you know, and I certainly watch a lot of that sort of thing myself, which is why I don't sleep very well. But when you're getting into contacting spirit and saying you're speaking for someone, I think that's when the water gets less murky and more black. So Burns channeled this murdered man over multiple sessions. And again, because memory was the first thing to go, he couldn't offer any more insight into the nature of his murder, where he was hurt first, where he passed away, all these sort of things. But
Marilyn Monroe remembered her first husband.
But the questions that were posed to Bill were very specific and very loaded to the case, you know. And all of his answers were quite vague, but also could be quite upsetting. But after I watched these, I could go further into them. I don't feel like it's appropriate, certainly not for this podcast. But after this, on YouTube when you watch them, when it comes up of people who watch things like this might also like this. And all of it was recent videos relating to other very high profile murders and high profile crime cases where people had put themselves at disappearance sites, at murder sites, and were trying to contact the deceased individual or walk through their footsteps. And these videos were into the tens and hundreds and millions of views. And I think this is where, as much as we can laugh about celebrity seances and things like that, because to a point we feel like the image of the individual is sort of collectively owned, or at least the entertainment aspect of them is collectively owned, when we apply that to people who have been victims of crimes, we start to really devolve.
Oh, especially when it's validated by close friends and members of the family, like you say with David Guest, who might have been friends with Michael Jackson and with Lynn and Bob Zamuda.
Yes.
But it's very simple. Like, it's so simple it's untrue. Yeah. Don't click it. It's as simple as that.
Absolutely.
Don't click it, even out of curiosity, even out of, oh, let's just see how awful this is. Just don't click it. Don't quote tweet it. Don't, all those things. But that will never happen. I'm shouting into the void when I say things like that. And as long as you do that, you contribute to the problem. And I'd like to see someone conduct a seance. Here's one that I would watch. Somebody conducting a seance with Bill Burns. Because I'll quite happily watch 40 minutes of somebody screaming as the lake of fire laps against their body.
Oh, God. Okay. Well, on that note, let's draw that celebrity seance corner to a close.
You've made me cross on purpose today.
Who's this coming through the door? Did you enjoy that, lads?
They've got nothing to say.
Oh, God.
They're as furious as I am. There we go. That was Loopholes, episode 22.
I did a great job, didn't I?
I've got to go and record another podcast now where I've got to be upbeat. And at the moment, I'm genuinely just furious. I'm really genuinely cross.
Well, you know, I like to bring, you know, a nice little fun familiar thing and then some general social outrage.
I'm not blaming you, but it's just horrific, that is. How do we live in a world where this is tolerated on any level, shape or form? I don't mean mediums just as a general thing, although I would, you know, personally say that, of course, but how are villains celebrated? I don't understand it.
Many mediums that had quite large public followings sort of maybe dwindled in popularity a little in the age of social media, that then ended up dipping their toe into true crime, or even, you know, psychic cops and people like that that dip their toes into true crime. I think ultimately just we can follow that journey from televised seances through to YouTube seances and spirit box sessions where people claim to have contacted very real or very, very current victims of crime. And I think that's where the nice fluffiness of esoterotica starts to really wear thin. And I've personally seen a lot of that recently with the high profile disappearances and crimes there's been.
But even if you believe with all your heart that they're genuinely talking to that person, how do you not stop at some point and go, this is really inappropriate? This is just so inappropriate.
Yeah. It's placing yourself in the centre of another family's grief. Certainly is at the minute.
I know that's big business at the minute. Well, I think I've been long, weirdly, criticised for being overly empathetic. But I don't understand how you can follow that through. You know, I know you said about when it's a celebrity. I do kind of give it a pass from an entertainment point of view. It's entertaining. But we discussed it as well with the Michael Jackson seance, in that, you know, I've no issue with David Guest being there. I've no issue with using Michael Jackson, even though he's away and has no say in the matter. I have less of an issue because he was public property. And with all the problems that came with that, by the way, that appear to have been conveniently forgotten. But I'll accept that that's a thing. These are people that are in the public eye. Ditto with Andy Kaufman as well, but we said with that seance as well that them kids who were on that program, the young people who were on that program who were big fans of Michael Jackson, were in genuine distress. They were in genuine distress, and we could argue that it was tears of joy or whatever, but nah, you know, and it becomes morally very questionable. I've questioned my own entertainment at that programme. That's the bit that jolts me out of that programme. When I see them and I go, oh, I feel uncomfortable watching this.
It's when it becomes real and they become less of an icon or a picture and more of a person.
And I also feel that, yeah, it's my personal opinion, that nobody should be talking about crimes apart from the police. Discussing and speculating on what's happened to people or what did happen there and all that, apart from actual trained authorities with that, you know, it just feels parasitic to me. Especially if you're benefiting financially from it as well. It feels utterly parasitic on utterly tragic occurrences. And I feel that about, you know, the rise of the true crime podcast, true crime TV, the rise of biopics of serial killers and all that. It's just really yucky. It's awful. And when, you know, you have the argument of, well, we humanise that person. It's like, well, I don't need you to humanise that person. I understand that they were a human being and I understand the magnitude of their crimes as well, the horror of their crimes as well. I don't need you to condescend to me and go, well, they were a person and things happened in their childhood and all that. So I don't care. I don't care what happened in their childhood. They should be an afterthought, way, way after we talk about the actual people that died. And even those people, I'm slightly uncomfortable with the idea of defining them by their grisly end as well.
Yes, yeah.
You know, but just me and it, I'm shouting to a void. So how can people get in touch, Kate?
Right. Well, if you'd like to get in touch, there are many means that you can do so. You can leave a comment on our Patreons, patreon.com/IanBaldsworth and patreon.com/burialsandbeyond. You can find us on Facebook at Loopholes Podcast, Instagram at Loopholes Pod, Twitter at Loopholes Pod, and you can send us an email at loopholespodcast@gmail.com. I've been Kate Cheryl.
I've been Ian Baldsworth.
And we'll see you next week. Bye.
Goodbye.
Loopholes is an Infinite Hermit production in association with Burials and Beyond, with Kate Cheryl and Ian Baldsworth. Music by Thomas Funderay, produced by Ian Baldsworth.